In 1498, in the course of what was his third voyage to the Americas, Columbus and his little fleet of ships approached the mouth of the Orinoco River, what is today Venezuela. As the little fleet approached the mouth of this river, Columbus had a sense that the water was turbulent, thrusting against his ships with an unnatural force, as if the waters that came out of the river were falling at a great speed from a great height. His spyglass told him that the shore was luxuriant with tropical foliage. He could espy a little way up from the mouth of the river that the river branched off into four tributary streams. There were flocks of various animals grazing on the shores of the river. The riverbed seemed to sparkle as if there was gold and precious jewels underneath, whose light was being refracted by the light of the sun. And here and there in the jungle, he could spy a nude, beautifully shaped form of a native. This seemed to be a propitious landfall. But Columbus, the intrepid adventurer, did something quite strange. He turned to the man who was steering his ship, and he ordered his ship and the fleet to turn about to set sail for their home base in Hispaniola. Now, what could have caused Columbus to avoid this shore? What warned him off? Columbus, of course, was the child of an age of faith, and he was born to this continent in large part because of some of the prophecies in the Book of Faith. In Columbus knew well the story which begins our Bible, the story of the Garden of Eden. A God had planted a garden in the east, a well-watered place, surrounded, bounded by four rivers, a luxuriant place whose growth was green and rich, a place in which there was the primitive man whose soul had not been scarred by civilization, a man and a woman who knew no aggression, no violence, no evil. He knew the myth of the Garden of Eden. And he knew, too, that according to our Bible, the Garden of Eden was now shut to man. Adam and Eve had eaten of the forbidden fruit, and they had been driven out by God from the garden. According to Genesis, God had planted before the garden a cherub, an angel, and a two-bladed sword turning hither and there, guarding the gate that none might return to the garden and might enter into it. Man was banished from the Garden of Eden. He might not return there. And in his dispatch to his employers, Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain, Columbus indicated simply, felt that I was approaching the Garden of Eden, and I feared to have my ships and my men approach any closer, for I know that God would not allow any to enter Eden whom he had not specifically commissioned to do so. The myth of the Garden of Eden is one of the most familiar in all of our history, and one of the most powerful. It lingered from biblical days in all of its force until certainly through the medieval period. And the Garden of Eden was not looked upon as a myth, an image, a figment of man's imagination, but as an actual place. Etymologically, Eden means a steppe land, a plain land. And it was the garden that was established in the plains to the east. And in the maps that Columbus carried with him, maps which charted the known space and left great blanks for the unknown, you would have seen that in the charts of the world, Jerusalem was pictured as the center, and there, somewhere far off in the east, there would be a green space surrounded by four rivers marked Eden. Columbus still believed that Eden was a piece of land, a a piece of geography that could be found. And he was sailing east of Jerusalem to the East Indies, a place where Eden might logically be. Now, the story of the Garden of Eden is one which is, of course, of great consequence to biblical man. The story of a place which was filled with all manner of good, where men existed in a natural, untarnished, uncomplicated, innocent state, was not unknown in the Middle East, but the biblical people seem to have made much more of it than any of the surrounding cultures. It was a theme that was well known. It was a subject of sermons in biblical times. The prophet Ezekiel is moved by God to utter a message at one point against a king of Tyre. Ezekiel lived during the 6th century, just before and during the Babylonian exile. We don't know why God specifically wanted this message of doom and punishment brought to the king of Tyre. But in any case, it is phrased in the imagery of Eden. Tyre is a city-state in what is today Lebanon. It's a rich country, a small, narrow coastal plain full of green things, and back of it rise the Lebanon mountains with the tall cedars, the symbol of vegetation, of natural power and beauty. It was a rich country. And Ezekiel begins as he speaks to the king of Tyre, "Thou wast in Eden, the garden of God. You had all good things in your country, but you polluted the land by your acts of violence, by the violence with which you imposed your trade upon others, by your arrogance. You believed that because you lived in a prosperous country, you lived there because of your own virtue, would not listen to any other, you were contemptuous of all others. Therefore, I, God, that is, will send the cherub who will drive you out of Eden, and you will live out the rest of your days the despoiled and desiccated earth." We have here what might be called the first ecological sermon. God has given man the good earth, an earth which is sufficient to the needs of men. But men, by their greed and their avarice and their selfishness, pollute this earth, destroy its beauty, take away its fertility, until they must be driven from paradise, if not physically, by destroying the paradise in which they live. And none of us who live on this continent, in this land, a continent of beauty, an empty space filled with all the wonders that God could ever have, which we could ever imagine Him, God to have blessed us with. We who are the children and the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren of those who raped and despoiled this continent, who have abused its resources. We hardly need to have chapter and verse drawn for us of the implications of the theme of the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden is paradise locked behind us. A beautiful space, God's space, in which man lived in some kind of natural bliss. Space from which we have been driven out into this cold, difficult world, where we must make the best of what we find here. Paradise cannot be unlocked. Paradise cannot be re-entered. Columbus turned because he feared the wrath of God if he entered into Eden. Interestingly, in our Talmud, you'll find a story which is told about Alexander the Great, the boy emperor of Macedon who conquered the Middle East, the known world. A young man who was trained by Aristotle, who was fascinated by the wisdom and the learning of the world, and who was reputed to have sought it out in his brief life wherever he could find it. Around the figure of Alexander, 1,000 stories are told, and some of these appear in the Talmud in a tractate known as Tamid. And one of them tells of an imaginary visit by Alexander into the deepest recesses of the jungles of Africa. He went down the Nile, seeking the wisdom that lay deep within the recesses of the dark continent. And during that voyage, he came upon an oasis, and there was a well in that oasis, and he discovered blow, and behold that all the dried food which he had specially prepared for this long trip, when it was touched by the water of this well, became fresh and sweet again, though it had been salted and dried to be preserved for the journey. By being dipped in the water of this well, it was suddenly as if it was fresh food, freshly picked from the tree. And he was amazed at the magic of these waters, and he said, surely these are the waters of the Garden of Eden. And he looked down into the well, according to the Talmud, and he saw at the base of the well a door. And being an imperial character, he shouted down into the well, open the door, let the door be opened. And the well, speaking in perfect biblical Hebrew, wells always in the Talmud speak in perfect biblical Hebrew, responded to him with a phrase from the Psalms, Ki zeh sha'ar Adonai v'atzadikim yavou bo. This is the gate of God, and only the righteous can enter into it. Only the totally righteous, the totally saintly man can re-enter paradise, and there is no man so righteous that he sinneth not. The Talmud, Columbus, the image, all conspire to insist that the myth of paradise, though we think of it in green, calm, Pacific terms, is essentially a melancholy, a tragic myth, which seeks to tell us that we live now in the world as we find it, and there is no return to the world of grace and innocence that was. The very word paradise is an interesting word. The Hebrew word pardes means an orchard. It comes from the Persian, which apparently means a walled-in orchard, a walled-in garden. And the emphasis is on the wall. Because in old Persian, I'm told, that the root of the word pardes or paradise means a wall made out of muddy or sticky substance, a wall of mud or a wall of water. What we have here essentially is the womb. 3,000 years before Freud, somehow the language itself reveals that men knew that the myth of the Garden of Eden says something about the reality of birth. In the womb, walled in, we have everything, all the nourishment, all the security that we need, and then we're suddenly thrust out into a cold world. And we must accept this world for what it is. There's no crawling back in. However much at night we may bend over in our beds and suck our thumbs, there is no return to the womb. We may dream of the Garden of Eden, but we cannot return there. So what is Eden? Eden is the innocence of childhood. Before life became complicated, we recognized that we were not the center of the world and we were not secure in this world. What is Eden? Well, I guess the best definition of Eden is simply all is implied in that caustic, rueful comment of George Bernard Shaw. It's too bad that youth is wasted on the young. Eden is all the ideas which we project back into childhood, into those years of happy, blissful innocence before the burdens of the world began to weigh in upon us. What is the meaning of Eden? On a personal level, the meaning of Eden is simplicity itself. We are, and we must accept what we are. There's no profit in playing the game, if only I had been born at another time. If only I had been born with another physical frame. If only I'd been born into a more noble or patrician family. If only I had been born within some other culture, with some other religion. If only I could exchange the bundle of talents which is mine for another, which is riper and fuller and more, which I might develop more competently. We must accept what we are as all that we will be and learn to live without self-pity, without dreaming of a world which we cannot change. What is the meaning of Eden? Eden is the reality principle. I suspect it's not a matter of chance that the myth of Eden begins our Bible. Because Eden insists upon a tragic truth. We live in this world. We cannot exchange this world for any other. And this world is not the best of all places. It is not paradise. This biblical story emphasizes it again and again. When Adam and Eve were driven out of the garden, God made no promise to them. What did he say? Cursed be the ground because of you. In anguish shall you eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles shall it bring forth for you, and you shall feed on the grains of the field. By the sweat of your brow shall you get bread to eat, until you return to the ground, for from it you were taken. For dust you are, and unto dust you return. Now man has always objected to the stark realism of Eden, of the beginning of the Bible. He's not wanted to accept the world for what he finds it to be, because it has been brutal and bruising and life is brief. He has wanted something better, a hope that life can be more than he knows it, he recognizes it, he suffers it to be. And even in our Bible, we find the myth of Eden transposed to a myth of the end of time. Yes, the Garden of Eden and its tragic truth describes the world as we find it, a world of insufficiency, a world of cruelty, a world of violence. But at the end of time, the prophet who wrote at the end of the book of Isaiah tells us, God says, I will create a new earth and a new world. And man will live on this earth fully. Every child will live out his full measure of days, and every elderly person. And a man shall plant a vineyard, and none shall take it from him. And a man shall plant a field, and he shall eat the full value of its produce. Nature will be transformed. The ox, the lion shall eat straw. The lamb and the wolf shall lie down together. Violence will have no place in this world. They shall know neither hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. Biblical man tried to transpose the myth of the Garden of Eden into a myth of the end of days, when God would wave a magic wand and create a lev chadash, ruach chadasha, a new heart and a new spirit for man. And we would have a world in which men are not as we see them to be and sometimes know ourselves to be, quixotic and selfish and ambitious and even violent. But men will be like the children of nature in paradise, simple, innocent, and calm and full of nothing but love, and nothing but laughter. In our rabbinic tradition, the Garden of Eden, Gan Eden, is transposed into a term which describes heaven, paradise, the abode of the righteous unto eternity. And so biblical man and rabbinic man try to mitigate the hard, melancholy truth which is implicit in the story of the Garden of Eden by transforming the story into a myth which they said applied not only to the beginning of the time, but will apply again at the end of time. Now, modern man sets little value by these eschatological images of the end of time, be they of God transforming human nature, or be they of God bringing the righteous into some heavenly paradise. These seem mystical and medieval and full of superstition and things of which we set very little value. But we too have fought against the concept of paradise as locked, and we have insisted in the last several hundred years that paradise is not, may have been locked, but we have the key with which we can open that lock, that paradise can be now. And that key is science, and that key is technology, and that key is medicine. That key is all of the fruits of human research and knowledge which will give us things and ease the burden of our lives. And there seemed to have been proof that we were approaching paradise and that we need not fear to approach paradise. And that proof seemed to be all about us. Instead of living in poverty, we lived in near affluence, abundantly. The lifespan was extended and extended again until it nearly doubled in 2 centuries. Our lives were healthier. Our lives were easier. We didn't seem to be cursed by having been driven out of paradise. We seemed to have come to that point in human development when through our skills we would build paradise here on earth. And I suspect that this confidence remains part of the stuff of which most who live in the West still breathe and hold to be true. In the last 10 or 15 years or so, most of us who are not too obstinate in our hopes have had to recognize that perhaps our feelings that we had the key to unlock paradise were a bit premature. Yes, if we had retained the population of our world at the level it was a century ago, we had enough of all good things to have maintained a decent level of subsistence and of life for all peoples who were in our world. But we multiplied in geometric proportions. And we began to abuse the natural resource of this earth and abuse it with increasing intensity and rapacity. And now it doesn't take much for our scientists to look just 20 or 40 years down the path and to see where we will have destroyed, used up our resources of natural energy, our living space, our capacities to create an environment which has any amenity, any beauty for man. We have come to one of those watersheds in history where man must recognize that despite all the new knowledge, despite all the new land which the age of adventure and exploration opened up to us, despite the new health, the length of life which is ours, despite or in part because of all of these things, we live in a world which can no longer promise us more that is graceful, more that is abundant, more that is good. And it begins to look as if, in part, paradise remains locked to us. The image of the utopias which is now being drawn is of a wasteland, is of 1984, dark and melancholic. Too many people cramped in too little a space, fighting desperately with one another for an inadequate supply of natural resource, drowning in their own mountain of things, because none of us has been sufficiently careful of the blessings which God has placed here for our use. Of all tragedies which have ever afflicted the children of men, perhaps none is more melancholic than the carelessness and the ruthlessness with which man has in the last several centuries abused. And the question before us today is simply this: can we survive with our numbers, with this carelessness, with a greed that somehow is implicit in human nature as we know it? Can mankind survive on this earth? I sometimes wonder if men have not worried too much about destroying each other in an atomic cloud, and worried too little about destroying each other simply by there being too many men and our being too careless of those things which surround human life. We've applied our skills, our ingenuity, our knowledge to things, to the creation of machines. We have not applied the same kind of determined mental energy, finding ways in which we can live, survive, not in abundance, but in sufficiency, in which we can survive as a common community of peoples, limiting, obviously, population, providing decency for those whom we bring into this earth. Story of the Garden Eden deliberately begins our Bible. It's the opening chapter and the opening truth. Here we are. There's no point bemoaning our fate that we weren't born 2-3 generations ago before we recognized and acknowledged that even this vast country, empty, so full, even this vast country can be abused and despoiled. What's for it then? Shall we dream of God interfering in this universe to create a new paradise on earth? Shall we delight ourselves, as do some of the more innocent among us, with new visions of a spiritual paradise at the end of time where we, as the righteous, as the believers, will be translated? Perhaps some will be satisfied with that. I, for one, am more satisfied with the biblical truth. And that is that though the Bible insists that we begin by acknowledging that paradise is lost, is locked, it presents to us in the rest of the biblical text a program, a discipline, which can make it possible for us to live decently in the world as we know it and as we find it. And these are the mitzvot, the duties, the laws, the obligations, the responsibilities that rest upon man. For the last generations, men have coddled themselves. We've all been very easy with ourselves. We haven't wanted to think of specific obligations, specific disciplines, specific restrictions. We've wanted to think of opportunity, of freedom, of expressing ourselves. We've talked, about love and about sympathy and about charity and about understanding and about brotherhood, all of these great empty values, empty simply because they don't apply in any specific way. The shoe never binds on us. The Bible doesn't speak very often of the great overarching words, love and righteousness and justice. It speaks in quite specific terms. You may not abuse the earth. 1 year in 7, the earth must lie fallow. 1 year in every 50, the earth must revert to its original owners, because no man can claim to himself possession of the earth. The earth belongs to God ultimately. It belongs to man, not to a particular man. The Bible insists that the earth and its blessings belong to the common weal, not to the man who has the money to exploit it, and not to the nation which has a monopoly on research or machines or power, but to mankind. The biblical law is specific. It's specific in terms of our duties to our fellow men. It's specific in terms of the responsibilities which we have within community. It's specific in terms of its understanding of our role here as stewards, not as owners, as those who must conserve the wealth of the earth, not as those who must digest it. We haven't wanted to listen to the mitzvot of the Bible. We've wanted to listen to the sirens who call us out to adventure and to enjoy and to great leisure. We, if not we, our children and our children's children are going to pay, I'm afraid, a terrible price for the carelessness and the thoughtlessness of modern man. We can all see how to a young person in India, Bangladesh, in Latin America, in parts of Africa, the myth of the Garden of Eden and the non-promissory promise with which man is faced when he leaves this. Thorns and thistles shall it bring forth from you. You shall feed on the grains of the field. By the sweat of your brow shall you get bread to eat until you return to the ground. For from it you were taken. For dust you are, and to the dust you shall return. We can see how this truth is still applicable to these impoverished peoples. What we have difficulty recognizing is that it is becoming applicable to us again today. For our prosperity is temporary. It is limited. There are only a number of years more in which we can rape the earth for the ingestion of a few wealthy nations. Then the earth will give out. Are we prepared, you and I and our country and the powerful of the world? Are we prepared to discipline ourselves now, to restrain our appetites, to learn again what it means to live with a sense of community, to serve the community people more than we serve ourselves? Are we prepared to live with less things? If not, our grandchildren may not live. For experiment after experiment by the scientists of the world have shown that when you introduce too many animals into a given life space, the animals fight with one another and destroy each other, and those who are survived become catatonic, mad, powerless, helpless. Is that the future we want for those who are of our own flesh? To have so abused their inheritance, we make it almost impossible for them to live. Now, the story of the Garden of Eden is obviously not truth. It's suggestive. It puts before us a melancholic understanding of our fate, which I'm afraid all of us must conjure with and deal with and come to some kind of terms with. For it speaks a truth that Western man has sought to deny. Paradise is locked, and we are left on this finite earth with its finite resources, possessed of only two redeeming qualities: a mind which can perceive truth, and a will which can apply what we perceive to our lives. Will we see? Will we have the courage to sacrifice? Amen.